everybody. Good evening. Welcome to tonight's symposium entitled What's IL-23 Got to Do with It? And we're going to be talking about targeted therapies in the management of IBD. I am Marla Dubinsky from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. And I'm really delighted to be joined by my colleagues, both Corey Siegel from Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center and David Hudesman from NYU. So we're going to move forward and do some housekeeping and then really dig into an understanding of where we are. I'm going to sort of set the stage as to where we are in terms of our strategies and how we approach inflammatory bowel disease. And then Corey's going to talk a little bit about the mechanism of action surrounding IL-23s and novel ways to think about the MOAs. And then Corey and Dave are going to dive into the actual data across all of the IL-23s. So we've got a lot of great data, and then we're going to have some case discussion, because I think really when you have a lot of therapeutic options, it's sort of hard to know how to interpret the data and how to use them in clinical practice. So that's where we find the most clinical applicability of tonight. And we really want to encourage live interactivity, meaning we have iPads, as you just saw, how to work them, but really want to be able to engage. So if there are questions that come up, I want to hear directly from you. I'm going to be manning the iPad and probably stopping my friends along the way to really talk about the important questions that are coming up as we introduce some new data. So this activity is supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs and both our J&J companies. Today our activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters and jointly accredited provider of continuing education worldwide. So, since anyone who knows, I'm very popular on X, don't even know what that actually means. I have a hashtag, but I'm actually not on it. Given my naivete around social media, what I can tell you is that we have a lot of folks streaming out there. We've got hundreds of folks out there, so welcome to you as well. And also want to encourage everyone to join the conversation today on a live conversation on X. With at CME Outfitters, and we'll be monitoring the feed as well and responding to your posts as they come in. And I already talked about the role of where we want to go with regards to the Q&A. So, as noted, I'm going to dive in, and these are where we're from, but you already heard where we're from, and really I think it's more important that we get into the learning objectives of tonight, so you're going to get a sense of what we're going to be setting up tonight's conversation and dialogue to be about. Obviously the role of cytokines, particularly in understanding in the role of inflammation, not just IBD, really gaining a new understanding of the way we think about the skin, the joints, and the gut, and why these more targeted therapies are really important as we think about positioning in our practice. That's objective one. Objective two is to classify the role of IL-23, IL-17 in the inflammatory axis as it relates to IBD pathogenesis, and also evaluate the clinical implications of IL-23 antibodies in the treatment of inflammatory bowel disease, and looking at the role of CD64 receptors, which Corey's going to go through because there's a lot of discussion around the activity of these 23s and where there may be some actual mechanistic differences around the way that these drugs actually work. So we're going to start by kicking off with our icebreaker questions and hear from all of you as to what are or is the most difficult aspect of patient care for inflammatory bowel disease. One, keeping up with all the new therapies and knowledge around these therapies. Prior auth, our favorite friend. Drug positioning, meaning how do I take all of these therapies and think about them in the way that I want to use them and in what order? And does sequence matter? We talk a lot about sequencing. Loss of response and what to do with that patient. Lack of time with patients and staffing challenges. So if everyone can go ahead and we can vote and play the music. ages? Like, how about something a little younger?
Seems like a popular song, though. So.
They're making a comeback. All right, so here are sort of, isn't that interesting, the prior auth and drugs positioning, and I think it's important for us to keep these in mind as we progress through the night, and I'm guessing questions will come in, and if not, I'm gonna chase you guys down and ask you, and remember these are the challenges and how do we go about it. Prior auth, that's for like a whole other therapy session, but really focused on understanding the therapies, how do we position them, how do we manage loss of response, I think is going to be an important part of our discussion.
You mean therapy session with like a psychologist?
Yes,
therapy session?
I need a therapist to talk about prior auths. But so let's focus a little bit on thinking about how we're thinking about these therapies and how the field is evolving and where we need to be in our understanding of where the goals of treatment are changing, but as well, is there a changing target? So, oh my, it's moving on its own. Can you guys put the, that slide. I'm going backwards, by the way, the slide's okay. Awesome. Thank you for going forward. All right. So defining the goals of treatment. So I think really starting to think about foundationally where we have come when we think about treatment goals. So if you remember, in 1998, our first ever really most impactful revolution was when infliximab was approved for Crohn's disease. And just thinking about the idea that drugs were approved based on subjectively, have you felt better over the last 7 days? And not just really better, but just felt better, meaning a Crohn's disease activity index score of 70 points. That was our first, foray or entree into what matters is subjectively, are patients feeling better? And then as we progressed, we went from not just are you feeling better, but are you really feeling better? And we moved into remission, not just clinical response. And thankfully, using the treat to target or the STRIDE guidance, which we put out in 2015. So going back to 2015, well before therapies needed to meet an endoscopic outcome, particularly in Crohn's disease. And you see, we've always been using endoscopy because it was part of the Mayo score, right? So there was always in UC an endoscopic or a mucosal outcome that was part of the trial. All granted in a composite score and now sort of separated between symptoms and mucosal disease in UC, but really gaining an understanding that we set the stage in 2015 that the target, not only do we want patients to feel better, but we also need to reach an objective target. And in 2015, the first STRIDE guidance, calprotectin and CRP was actually, there was not enough data to say, use surrogates to actually treat optimized, meaning if Calpro and CRP was, you should scope. Not 100% accurate that they should be the reason why you optimize therapy. Fast forward to 2021 when the STRIDE 2 guidance was published, which said that not only do you need endoscopy, but you also could think about using calprotectin and CRP as an intermediate target to actually optimize. And also in pediatrics was the addition in 2021 where we said kids need to grow. If they're not growing, that is a surrogate that you don't have controlled inflammation. And endoscopy was still our treat to target. So whether it's at 6 to 12 months, doing a scope was the target of interest. And as you know, finally, regulatory agencies in Crohn's disease with risankizumab and forward, all drugs are not coming to the market unless they've met an endoscopic outcome, which is fantastic. But that was the first Crohn's drug, really, that was held to coming to market, reaching endo. And then IOIBD, which is the International Organization of Inflammatory Bowel Disease, said IBD doesn't end at 12 months. There's a lifetime of disease modification that actually needs to happen. And so we put this SPIRIT concept, which is moving beyond 1 year, and really saying we need to modify the disease. So now that we've all gotten to a point where there's this treat to target, which many of us are not practicing treat to target medicine, but is getting more momentum, we also need to understand that we need to treat to an endpoint to reduce surgery, change the trajectory, reduce disability, improve quality of life. Also, along with this landscape change of us moving the target, and I said regulatory finally caught up in Crohn's disease that you need to actually move towards the endoscopic target, look how crowded this market is really for us. No wonder why drug positioning is confusing, because look what happened since 2022, for goodness sakes. I mean, you're talking the whole, there's such an explosion, right, over the last 3 years. I mean, we sort of got excited when 2014 led to something new outside of a TNF, and then 2016 with ustekinumab for Crohn's, and then we sort of had a lull, and then really taking off, and we started to see JAKs in UC, and then really the 23 to me has been the next revolution outside of TNFs. And just like we struggle, I think, between all the TNFs at the beginning, trying to differentiate which one we would use when, I think we're now facing that. And I think TL1A will be yet the next competition or revolution, which is there's going to be multiple TL1As. How am I going to use them? And I think tonight I really want to have the audience walk away with some pearls on what you're thinking about when you have more than one drug within this class. But probably, to me, the most humbling part is actually this slide. So Corey, I'm going to show you this slide and then the next slide. And Corey, these were claims data, correct, that you used to publish on this. And this was just the idea that despite the slide I just showed you, we are still not using appropriate effective therapy first line, even forget first line, within 2.3 years of diagnosis. And I'd venture to tell you, Corey, that with ulcerative colitis, at least we have mesalamine as a treatment for mild to moderate. Mesalamine is not approved for moderate to severe disease. So if you have a patient who has moderate to severe disease, you need to be using an advanced therapy. And as far as I know, for Crohn's disease, other than a short course of Entacort, there or budesonide, there is nothing approved for Crohn's disease. So why is only 14% of Crohn's patients getting access to or getting prescribed advanced therapy?
Yeah, there are a lot of reasons, and you're right. This is humbling and to me, really frustrating. You know, we've had, you're going to talk about more recent top-down data, but we've been learning and understanding top-down therapy since 2008. You know, 2008, we've known that this is a strategy that is effective and significantly more effective than this kind of step-up, you know, therapy that we typically do. So we did this study a few years ago that we published back in 2021, but the data went to like kind of 2019, and you can make an argument that we just weren't catching up yet. You know, all these drugs that you just showed weren't there. We're not really making great progress. So we redid it, and this just got published over the past few months. And this is going to now the end of 2021, and still, you know, people aren't using the therapy. So this is a mixed payer database across the United States. This is representative of people getting treated in the U.S. with inflammatory bowel disease, and we're missing the boat, because that window of those first 2 years is critically important, and something's going on with why they're not getting prescribed it. There are probably eight reasons why. It's not just one. It's not, I promise you, it's not prior authorizations that's in the way. That's not the problem. I think it's actually us as a field not being aggressive or intensive enough treating our patients before they get sick. We're waiting for them to get really sick and then pull the trigger, but we're missing the boat.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked a lot about risk stratification and saying that proactively being able to match the disease severity, however defined, not disease activity, because that's what the disease severity index really showed, is that if we're just focused on how many stools you're having or how much blood you're having, but not take into account how they got to you, right, you know, what their journey was and risk factors for progression, I think we're also missing the boat. Particularly in Crohn's, time matters.
Agree. And just keep in mind, the little bullet on the bottom right of that box, almost 80% of these patients got steroids. So these aren't patients with mild disease. I mean, they were symptomatic enough to receive steroids, yet within 2 years, you could see the proportion that got any advanced therapy at all.
I mean, how much do you think, if you had to pick the biggest barrier, what would you say it is?
I think it's hard to, you know, it's harder to start an advanced therapy when you're sitting in front of a patient with limited time than just put them on 5-ASAs and prednisone, which is cheap, easy. You don't have a whole safety discussion, although, to be honest, you should have a safety discussion more with corticosteroids than our advanced therapies. And I think it's just committing to the fact that this is what our patients need and being confident about it. It's the path of least resistance, I think, for many of our patients, is they would prefer not to be on advanced therapy if they could. But it's our job as clinicians to explain to them that the risk of not being on good drugs is worse than any side effects of medications. And this is part of that same paper. This is what's called a Sankey diagram. And the different columns are showing you different lines of therapy. So this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines of therapy. And the weaving lines are weaving from going either from steroids to 5-ASA and steroids, over to immunomodulator, back to 5-ASA and steroids. And this is what's happening pre-biologic therapy. So if you're wondering what happens before they eventually get on biologics, it's this, which to me is really disappointing. Like, we know better as a field. We're just not doing it.
Yeah, so I think a couple of key points is that it still looks like steroids and 5-ASAs are first-line therapies for Crohn's disease. Particularly?
Yeah, this one's UC, but okay. The Crohn's one looks exactly the same.
Yeah, so which is even more
concerning.
Yes. Yeah. So one thing, as you saw, is that we're struggling to get the right patient onto an appropriate advanced therapy and match their moderate to severe activity with being on a drug approved for moderate to severe disease. I think one of the most humbling studies, but yet validating, is the PROFILE study. And I don't know if everyone is familiar with the PROFILE study. This is a study that there was this thought process, and Corey and I are very interested in biomarkers, and we had studied that together in the past around trying to find a biomarker to help communicate risk, meaning is there a blood test, is there a tissue test that could tell a patient and a provider this patient has a high risk of needing advanced therapy. That's how this biomarker was initially put out into the market. They actually were using it in Europe. It was a company called PredictImmune. Who was putting out a biomarker that was like RNA expression, gene expression, that predicted that you would need advanced therapy. So what they did is they did a study, noted the PROFILE study, and it was basically saying, comparing step-up therapy, which Corey said in 2008, we were told by that early effective study that was published, that steroids and 5-ASAs are not as good as starting infliximab. That was the study in 2008. This is a repeat. But it was the premise that what if I take people newly diagnosed Crohn's disease, literally within 15 days of diagnosis, individuals were on one of two paths. They were either on steroids plus an immunomodulator versus TNF, an immunomodulator, and both groups were able to start with steroids and then have a steroid weaning. So that's the purpose of PROFILE. Now, all of us could start to imagine that if you have a drug, very effective drug, used within 2 weeks of diagnosis, do you think it matters what your biomarker status was? Because the biggest problem is we're not using effective therapy early, particularly in Crohn's disease, and that's exactly what this study actually showed. So I'll look at the primary outcome just on the left, which are the graphs, and the blue are individuals who what we call top down, but we were joking before. I mean, who goes from combination therapy to 5-ASA. So even the nomenclature and the narrative we use, no one is stepping down or viewing top down. You may remove the combo, maybe, but you're certainly not going to step down to antibiotics or 5-ASAs in a Crohn's patient. So even the term top down isn't really used anymore, and it was great when we wanted to turn the pyramids around, when we were doing top down versus step up. But the terminology is just early effective therapy with an approved drug for moderate to severe Crohn's disease versus using two non-approved drugs. That's essentially what this study looked at. And you could see in the blue that patients who got top down did significantly better, steroid-free, surgery-free remission at a year. And then when you look at the blue and the red bars beside it, one blue, the one to the left, sorry, I'll use the pointer here, is that if you look here, this is biomarker positive or biomarker negative. It didn't matter as long as you got effective therapy early. So we don't need a biomarker to predict whether you're going to need surgery or complications. We just need to actually use effective therapy when a Crohn's patient is diagnosed. Pretty well, I think that to me, is what the profile study thought. Dave, what were you thinking?
No, I agree. And I think one of the major take-home messages is we're going to talk about how we differentiate our different therapies. But if you get on patient on drug early, you're going to do well, right, across the board.
And so how do you take that if safety and fears of, Corey, you noted, the fear of we're waiting for people to complicate and go, oh, you've got complicated disease. I'm now going to pull out a therapy that works for moderate to severe. They were moderate to severe from minute one. Endoscopy, PROs, it doesn't matter how you measure it. How do you move that to the clinic if we know that safety may drive decisions?
Yeah, I mean, I think the conversation has to change. We're all very defensive in clinic and talking about side effects of medications and spending all this time, which, you know, deserves its respect. However, we should be spending time talking about the longer-term adverse outcomes of undertreated disease. And I think we've gotten too stuck on talking about and defending what, you know, they hear about side effects and their worries. But if you ask patients what they're worried about, and we've done this, it's not side effects of drugs. It's bad outcomes of their disease. Like, that's what they're worried about. So I think our conversations just have to shift to make them understand that you may not feel horrible right now, or you may not be talking to a surgeon right now, but if we don't do something now, you're going to be talking to surgeons soon.
And just to add something clear, I think having that conversation early, when you first meet the patient, we all have patients that, you know, you say, I want to put you on this therapy, sure, doc, whatever you say. But most of our patients are going to be hesitant, right? So they might not get it that first time, but if you start that conversation early, the first time you see the patient the second time, and as you're monitoring them, they sort of start to understand what you're saying and be more willing to take that step.
Yeah, I think, and there's a few questions around IL-23, which we'll get to when we talk more about the data. There was a question saying that prior auth is a big barrier, and I think one of the responses back I would say is that a lot of the programs for commercial, not for everybody, there is sort of free, patient support and patient access for patients who, you know, it's denied or there's a major copay, you know, a significant copay, et cetera. So I think us also making sure our patients are using these resources, but we can get into that later. But I did want to say that there was a point that prior auth is an important barrier to maybe utilizations in response to your comment. It said specifically Corey Siegel, you were wrong. No, I'm kidding, it didn't.
Yeah,
but,
I understand.
You know, the concept.
And what you guys don't know is we can see actually who asked those questions.
No, just
kidding. But the fact is, one of the best things that's come out of that slide with all of the new drugs out there is competing programs to help patients. So, you know, it's hard to differentiate. We're going to talk about drug differentiation, but one way that all of these companies are trying to help us help our patients is programs that does take away this prior authorization barrier if you know how to use them. And that's the key, is working with the most valuable person on our team, don't tell the rest of my team, is our pharmacist, you know, who helps us figure out how we can quickly get drugs.
Not everyone has a pharmacist,
no,
Dr. Siegel.
But getting help.
As we move into all of the data and understanding the role of IL-23 in particular, I think one thing for me that really set the stage for us understanding that although all roads lead to TNF, that's why we use it across everything, and if you look at the column that has the gold boxes and you look at TNF across multiple immune diseases, all roads definitely lead to anti-TNF first, but it doesn't mean everyone responds to anti-TNF. That's a big struggle we have, but also, does everyone need a TNF, right? There are specific patient types and specific types of molecular biology that had really came out from this incredible New England Journal article that was written in 2021, actually, showing that we're now starting to think about diseases through cytokines. And IL-23, no shocker why drugs that we have are also approved for either RA or psoriatic arthritis and psoriasis is because there's such a huge overlap between the skin and the gut in particular and in the psoriatic space. So it's just showing you that we're starting to now group diseases, and it does help us understand that we have a lot of patients, by the way, who have a lot of extraintestinal manifestations. So it makes sense that we think not just about the gut, but we think about outside of the gut when we're making our decisions, because there's a lot of shared overlap. What the purpose of this slide is just to walk you through the importance of thinking about IL-23 as we're going to spend the rest of the evening, and some really great questions on IL-23s and outcomes and PROs. So I'm excited to really for you guys to dig in the data. But just understanding across the board really the fact that IL-23 exposure is needed for the development of the IL-17 pathway, which is such a critical pathway, and why everybody, even all the small molecules, have been going after turning down this impact on IL-23. You know, some of the microRNAs, so obefazimod, which is a new therapy class that's in clinical trial development, it's using microRNA to really look at the IL-17 pathway. So there's a lot of interest in why IL-23 and IL-17 is important. Now, we often take our lessons from dermatology, right? A lot of, because they get approved earlier than us. Now, the problem is the dosing for psoriasis is often, as we've learned our lesson, is very different than what we need for inflammatory bowel disease. So we know that in the derm space, all our dermatologists have always been talking about IL-23 and really using IL-23 as their signature approach to, obviously, psoriasis, psoriatic arthritis. There's higher rates, we know, actually, not just in the IBD space, where now we have the sequence study, which was risankizumab versus ustekinumab showing superiority. They saw the same thing in the psoriasis space. We're going to talk about Galaxy, which is guselkumab versus ustekinumab within their phase 3 program, as well as placebo. And mirikizumab in their phase 3 program for Crohn's also looked at versus ustekinumab. And I think you're going to start to see that really, for me, I don't know how you feel, but I have not, I'll be honest, since the 23s entered space, I haven't been using ustekinumab for Crohn's disease way back, because I learned from psoriasis, even before sequence actually happened. But for me, this was my movement in the space, is that there's data to support from psoriasis that there is a difference. And I don't know if it's dosing, because that's the biggest question we always get, or is there a true mechanism difference? And Cor, I'm going to ask you in a minute to walk through maybe even within the 23s, are there even differences in the actual MOA? And this is just reminding you some of the data points around the efficacy in psoriasis, looking at obviously the phase 3 studies, and you could see here even ustekinumab versus guselkumab and risankizumab. Just so we often take our reference and also talk to our patients about, when we didn't have drugs available, we would talk about the fact that these are coming and that there's a reason, and that there's a shift to IL-23s in psoriasis. So let's now move, Corey, to you talking a little bit about the MOA and what should we know.
Yeah, thanks. So, you know, I'll admit, when we first started hearing about 23s, I was suspicious that they weren't going to be any different than the 1223. So I think we'll get at two different things today. One is, are they different, you know, IL-23s versus IL-1223s? And then kind of the second level is, oh, now we have three IL-23s. How do we differentiate those? Are there a difference between those? So that's what we'll talk about here. First, a question for all of you, and we're going to get at this and then come back to the question later. So which of the following is true regarding binding affinity of IL-23 inhibitors to CD64 receptors? Is it binding of CD64 occurs only with risankizumab? Binding of CD64 occurs only with guselkumab? Binding of CD64 occurs only with mirikizumab, or it occurs with all three, or you're allowed to say you don't know. Oh, now we're talking.
Oh, my gosh. So old. David just said that was before his time.
Okay, we will come back to the question in a little bit. So this is the first level. This is there really a difference between the anti-P40s, which we refer to as the IL-1223s, and the anti-P19s, which we refer to as the IL-23s? And again, when we first started hearing this story, I wondered if there really was going to be a difference, or were these just new medications that we'll have in our armamentarium that we'll cycle through and won't be that different. As you probably know already, ustekinumab covers both of these. So it goes after IL-12 and IL-23. That's the way that P40 mechanism works. However, the P19, so IL-23s, just go after that one side of it, you can see, which is just IL-23 and does not hit IL-12. So again, ustekinumab goes after both, 12-23. Guselkumab, mirikizumab, risankizumab go after P19, just IL-23. So that's the first, is there's something that's pretty similar here, but the mechanism is different, doesn't make a difference. And when we get into the data, you know, you can tell us if you think that it makes a difference. But we have learned through all of these studies that Marla alluded to when they compared it to ustekinumab, that there is something different about these drugs and something's happening. And it's probably because of this, is that it's going after just IL-23, the more specific inhibition does something differently than when it's 12-23. So that's kind of level one, is are they different? And then level two, as I brought up, is, well, what about the different IL-23s? We have three. Can we tell them apart? Are they exactly the same? And they are similar, but they're not exactly the same. And I'll show you the mechanism, and you know, we can decide when we look at the data if this mechanism explains the data or if there's something else going on. But there is a story evolving here that, you know, we would like you to hear about and think for yourself if it makes sense. So here are two similar molecules, guselkumab on the left and then risankizumab on the right. The antigen recognition domain is the same on both of these. So again, they're both going after IL-23 in a very similar way. What's different is the bottom part of this molecule, the Fc domain. Now, we started talking about Fc regions back with anti-TNFs, right? That's when we learned. We all had to remember our medical school biology and molecular biology about what the difference was with Fc domains. But what's different here with Gus is that it has a native wild-type Fc domain, where risankizumab has a mutated LALA region there, and it's a humanized IgG1 as opposed to fully human IgG1. Now, again, all of this starts sounding very familiar, like, oh, we had this story with anti-TNFs, and we're not really sure it made a difference. But let me show you how this unfolds and how these molecules work, because there is something potentially different about the way these molecules are binding that might make a difference. Here's a nice schematic of how this looks. And you could see guselkumab, which is on the right, which is the fully human IgG1, again, with the native wild-type Fc region. And then risankizumab is on the left, which has this mutated LALA region, the humanized IgG1. So that's kind of how they look floating around. And when you throw IL-23 into the mix, initially they look the same. So again, the binding region of these molecules is the same. They both bind IL-23, and they do look the same at this point. There's not a lot of differentiation. However, something happens because guselkumab has a secondary process that's going on, which is binding to the CD64 receptor. And I'll show you in a couple of slides of how that's different. This is risankizumab here, which is showing that it binds IL-23 in circulation, but it's not doing anything binding to the CD64 receptor, which is cell-bound on the inflammatory myeloid cell. Now remember, the inflammatory myeloid cell is involved in immune surveillance, and that's where IL-23 is actually being made. So IL-23 is coming out of the cell, going into the circulation, and in this case, risankizumab is kind of capturing it while it's in the circulation. Now let's compare that to guselkumab. So it is capturing IL-23 in the circulation, but also it's binding to the CD64 receptor. So it's sort of like there are two different ways that it can capture IL-23. In northern New England, Mar, we call this wearing belt and suspenders, so you can have a second mechanism there. So you're getting it right at the source. You're getting it right where the IL-23 is coming out at the cell, and then also you get it in the circulation. So that's kind of a hypothetical something's going on here. But if you look at what's actually happening at the cellular level, you see something really interesting. The way to interpret these graphs is the one on the left, panel A, is looking at intracellular antibody. So how much of the antibody is actually getting into the cell? The blue bars that go up over time is guselkumab. So that's the one that's binding to CD64. However, risankizumab stays flat. So it's not getting intracellular, and it's, again, just kind of circulating out in the circulation. If you look at panel B, that's looking at intracellular IL-23. We want to recapture the IL-23. And again, the blue bar is guselkumab, and it's going up over time, where risankizumab, it just stays flat, and it's not getting incorporated intracellularly like it does when you have guselkumab. So again, something mechanistically is happening that's different here. In the circulation, it's all capturing IL-23, but at the cellular level, there's the secondary binding site that may be important. And when we look at the data, you can see why perhaps this is an explanation that's differentiating these molecules. Just to not leave out mirikizumab, this was done in a separate study, but we saw the same thing with mirikizumab as we do with risankizumab. The line that goes up is the positive control binding CD64, and the flat line on the bottom, just like risankizumab, was mirikizumab, which is not binding CD64, and again, not internalizing the IL-23, not internalizing the monoclonal antibody. So hope you're paying attention, because here comes the question again. Same question as before. I won't read through all of them again, but essentially this is asking which of the following is true regarding binding affinity of IL-23 inhibitors to CD64 receptors. Is it risankizumab, guselkumab, mirikizumab, all of them, or you're still not sure? We'll give you a second there. Do me proud. Yeah, very nicely done. Great. Well, thanks. So I think we've made the point there, and we kind of set the stage. So I will argue that doesn't matter unless the data shows you that it matters. So I'm going to hand it over to David and let you go through the data for UC, and then you're going to give it back to me for Crohn's disease in a little bit.
Perfect. Thanks, Corey.
Whoa.
We lost the slides.
Or not.
Yeah.
As we're working to get the slides back. So as Corey said, we're going to go through the clinical data right now. I'll discuss UC. Corey will go on to Crohn's. Just to remind everybody, we have three FDA-approved selective IL-23 inhibitors for UC. We have mirikizumab, risankizumab, and guselkumab. For Crohn's, we only have risankizumab, that's FDA approved, but we have a couple more that will likely be coming in the future. So this is a lot of data to go through, and I don't want to sort of get too much into the weeds, but what I want to do is sort of highlight some key parts of each key pieces of information from each trial and let you know how I look at the data, right? What am I looking for to help sort of say, yo, maybe this is the right therapy for my patient in my practice. And as Corey nicely showed, and everybody obviously listened, there are some mechanistic differences between the selective IL-23 inhibitors. We do not have head-to-head trials comparing them yet. So are there some suggestions or things we could pull out where maybe there is differentiation as we get more experience in our clinic and see some real-world data? So first, just to touch on study designs in IBD. So there's two major designs. There's the randomized withdrawal studies. These are studies where everybody gets drug versus placebo during induction. Then patients that responded to drug, they get re-randomized to drug versus placebo during maintenance for the rest of the year. And then you're looking at outcomes. So usually in these randomized withdrawal designs, the one-year outcomes, whether it's clinical or endoscopic response or remission, are going to be higher because you're taking people that responded and continuing them on, right? And then you have the treat-through design. And the treat-through design is what we're doing in our practices, right? We start patient on drug, we see how they do, and we continue them on, and hopefully they respond, and we look at what the outcomes are at the end of the year. So there's no re-randomization. For the UC data that I'm going to present, all the data is randomized withdrawal. What Corey's going to touch on, there'll be some randomized withdrawal and some treat-through. And that might explain the different levels of response and remission rates. All right, so to jump right in, the first selective IL-23 inhibitor FDA approved for ulcerative colitis was mirikizumab a little over a year ago now, and their trials were the Lucent 1 and Lucent 2, and what they did was they took patients and they same IV dosing, actually across all selective IL-23 inhibitors, where you get an IV dose once a month for three doses, and then the responders were re-randomized to 200 milligram injections every 4 weeks versus placebo. Now, it's important to realize with mirikizumab, when we're using it in our practice, this is two injections once a month with citrate. So looking at the outcome, so what do I look at when I'm looking at the trials? And now with so many different trials, I used to think I had a pretty good memory remembering the exact response and remission rates. It's pretty difficult to sort of keep track of all of this now. But what I really pay attention to is the deltas, right? So the difference between drug and placebo, and how does that compare from trial to trial? So if you look at the primary endpoint here is clinical remission, and across the UC trials, it's the same primary endpoint, clinical remission. Just to remind everybody, that's defined as a normal stool frequency, or going to the bathroom one or two times more than normal, no rectal bleeding, and a colonoscopy that's either perfect or close to perfect. So maybe some mild inflammation without friability. So that's clinical remission across the board that I'm going to show you. And you can see here that Mary outperformed placebo, and the delta or the difference was about 10%. You'll see the secondary endpoints. We see higher clinical response rates, and we see endoscopic remission, and I'm sure there'll be some discussion on hemi or histologic endoscopic mucosal improvement. I think it's important to realize with mirikizumab, always you want to understand how you're defining these endpoints. So endoscopic remission in the Miri data is a Mayo score or a perfect or near-perfect colonoscopy. So when you're looking at endoscopic remission here, and when we're going to look at risankizumab and guselkumab, that's almost looking at their endoscopic response or endoscopic improvement, so a little bit different. And then just to highlight on the right, so this is an urgency scale that Marla and her team created. And I think, you know, Marla was alluding to this earlier, right? We're talking about how many times a day you're going to the bathroom, are you seeing blood? But what's important to the patient? And urgency is probably one of the most impactful symptoms for the patient, whether they're making it to work each day, whether they're getting to class or school. So this is one of the first trials to look at urgency, and you're seeing now with all of our therapies, even outside of IL-23 inhibitors, we're incorporating more of these important aspects for patients, so urgency, fatigue, and so forth. And we'll touch on that a little bit more later, but you could see here with mirikizumab, you do have improvement in urgency during induction. Moving on to the maintenance data. So again, these patients are re-randomized, so the overall numbers are higher. And when you're looking at, again, just looking across the board, whether it's clinical remission, steroid-free remission, endoscopic remission, the deltas or the differences, this is what we want to see, right? They're over 20% in these re-randomized trials, 20, 25%. And I think just, again, to highlight what's important is the endoscopic remission here is a 0 or 1 Mayo score without friability. Now, the other thing I look at, which I think is very important, is what patients are getting put into the trial. So first, how many patients coming into this trial have been previously exposed to biologics or small molecules, and how does this data look, whether you were bio-naive or bio-exposed, right? And I think across the board, and what we said earlier, if we start patients on drug earlier, more naive patients, there's probably a good chance they're going to do better, right, earlier on. So what was nice, what we saw with mirikizumab here, whether you're looking at clinical remission or endoscopic remission, the deltas are the difference between drug and placebo in the naive patients versus the exposed patients are the same, right, or similar, right? The exposed numbers, the absolute numbers are always going to be a little bit less. If you look at endoscopy, 60% versus 50%, but that difference, right, is still about 30% between both, which would tell me if I have a patient that failed a therapy or two, this might be a good option for my patient. All right, moving to risankizumab, our second FDA-approved IL-23 inhibitor for UC, and this was just approved this past summer. So similar trial design, again, during induction, 3 IV doses once a month. Just the difference, this is a 1,200 milligram IV dose, which is different than Crohn's, right? So I know this was always, in the beginning, it's a 2-hour infusion versus a 1-hour infusion, so scheduling in the infusion center, sort of making sure the orders are correct, you need to work out that process. But it's 1,200 milligrams once a month for 3 months. And again, patients were re-randomized to every 8-week injections. There's 2 doses, similar to Crohn's. There's an 180 milligram dose every 8 weeks versus sub-Q versus a 360 milligram dose. All right, looking at the endpoints, so we just discussed what clinical remission was last time. We saw around that 10% delta with mirikizumab, similar but maybe a little bit higher here. Again, 2 separate trials with risankizumab with a clinical remission induction data of 20% versus 6%, so a difference of about 14%. And when you're looking at secondary endpoints, we see similar response rates. It's also nice to see they have some week four data, right? This is a pretty common question patients are going to ask, how quickly am I going to get better? So you can see here within a month, patients are seeing benefit. And I would say probably within those first 2 to 3 weeks, in those more naive patients, you'll start seeing that benefit, so you could set expectations for your patients. Endoscopic improvement here, we see a nice difference of 25% during induction. This is like the endoscopic remission data we just saw from mirikizumab or similar. Endoscopic remission not as good, which is expected, just 12 weeks into drug, and then histology. What about the bioexposed? So this is where we start seeing a little bit of a difference, right? So what we saw with mirikizumab was pretty similar. Now if you're looking at whether you're bio-naive versus bio-exposed clinical remission, during induction, bio-naive, a nice 20% difference, but in the bio-exposed population, not so much of a difference. We're talking about less than a 10% difference. When we go out to the maintenance data, that's something that we see, that holds true here as well. So looking at clinical remission in this re-randomized population at 1 year, overall a nice difference, but really what's driving that is the bio-naive patient population. And in a bio-naive patient population at 1 year, 60% in clinical remission, that's a good number. But in that bio-exposed, that difference isn't as good. And it's sort of similar across the board with secondary endpoints, just that what we saw with Mary, around a 15, 20, 25% difference between drug and placebo, depending on what we're talking about, clinical remission, endoscopic remission, steroid-free remission, or histology. All right, moving on to guselkumab, which was just FDA approved about 6 weeks ago now, give or take. So they had two induction studies. They had a phase 2B study where they were trying a couple different doses versus placebo. They saw that lower dose was hitting their endpoints, and so, which is, I think, an important part as well. I think we're used to earlier with our IBD therapies, or just give more, right? These drugs were underdosed. But I think now we're doing a better job, the companies are doing a better job sort of doing these dose-ranging studies. So they went with the lower dose in the phase 3. They combined these. They saw how patients did, so similar again, once-a-month infusions for 3 months. And then on to maintenance, where they were re-randomized. And there was two different dosing strategies. It was 100 milligrams sub-Q every 8 weeks or 200 milligrams every 4 weeks versus placebo. And you could see here, going through the primary endpoint, so again, clinical remission, we see a nice delta, right, about 15%. So similar when you're looking at the risankizumab data for clinical remission during induction. We see nice symptomatic remission, clinical response, really nice data with endoscopic improvement and histology as well. So similar but very good endpoints here across induction. This is now looking at maintenance. So these patients were re-randomized, and I want to highlight a couple things here. So now looking at clinical remission, we're seeing some differences now, close to 30%, highlighting endoscopic improvement. So again, this was endoscopic improvement similar to RISA, and similar to endoscopic remission in MIRI, of now close to 30% endoscopic improvement. Endoscopic normalization is essentially endoscopic remission. Perfect, normal-looking colon. You could see here pretty impressive numbers of close to 20% difference between drug and placebo. When we now break down just what we did with RISA, looking at bio-exposed versus bio-naive, these differences hold true in both situations. So, endoscopic remission on the left in bio and JAK-naive patients, we see a delta or difference of about 20%. When you're looking at endoscopic remission in patients that were exposed, we're still seeing great deltas anywhere from 15 to about 23%, and similar numbers across the board. So again, taking from this, this is a therapy that I would work great first line, right? But I would use it second line or third line in my patients as well. Just to touch on safety before I give it back to Corey to talk about Crohn's, I think we have a lot of experience with safety with these types of therapies, right? Ustekinumab was approved for psoriasis back in 2009. We know that's a very safe agent. We have some data from risankizumab with Crohn's from years prior. So I think we're very comfortable. And the way I explain it to patients, clinically, this is very similar to Veto, right? This is a very safe agent, using it in our sick patients with infection histories, with malignancies, and so forth. This is just looking at the safety across the trials, just to highlight a couple of things. You know, patients are always concerned, and we're concerned about infections. When we talk about serious infections, this is something that requires antibiotics or hospitalization, and only 3 patients, or 1%, had a serious infection. None with malignancies. Injection site reactions, you'll see, are pretty comparable across the board, around 5-ish%. For risankizumab, again, you see similar 5-7% injection site reaction rates, similar infection rates. And then for guselkumab, no malignancies, very low serious infections. So again, very safe agent, and I think one of our safest therapies when we're talking about this, and vedolizumab. So I'm going to pass it back to Corey to touch on the Crohn's data.
Thanks. If you go back to that last slide for a second, let me see if I can. The way I explain this to patients, and I'm not sure how you guys say it, is I say when they do these trials, and I think most of our patients understand this idea of a placebo group, that, you know, a group that didn't get, you know, real drug or didn't get drug. I say it's hard to distinguish between side effects between the placebo group and the group that got drug, except for the AEs that are related to their disease, which is flaring in the placebo group. So it's really hard to even say that there's much going on from a side effect profile here, which is great. Let me take that forward, and thanks, David, and bring this forward to Crohn's. We don't have quite as much data to go through Crohn's, mostly because we have one drug that's approved for Crohn's disease in the IL-23 class, which is risankizumab, and then we'll show you the data that we have available for guselkumab and mirikizumab as well. So ADVANCE and MOTIVATE are the induction trials for Crohn's disease. The only difference between the two is ADVANCE was a combination of both those who had failed conventional therapy, so non-advanced therapies, or those who had failed biologic therapy combined, where MOTIVATE was just the biofailure group. They actually don't look that much different. As David mentioned earlier, the biofailure group always has a little bit of a lower rate. But if you see here, we're seeing those deltas that you had suggested we would see, you know, compared to placebo. So an effective drug early in induction for Crohn's disease. And then when you look across at maintenance in Crohn's disease, you're seeing kind of the same pattern here, which was those in either clinical remission or endoscopic response. So clinical remission is that salmon-colored bar, endoscopic response, the beige bar with the crosshatches. And you see that there is a drop-off, as you would expect, between clinical remission and endoscopic response. But again, not much different in dosing. So as you had mentioned, you know, earlier, we're used to give more anti-TNF and we'll overcome anything. Here, we're not really seeing that across the 23s, which is interesting.
Now, only for the total population. When you start getting into the nuances around CRPs, there's actually a number of questions about the data you just showed, so we'll talk about it after that, and the overall population. But then when you get into markers of more significant disease, CRPs, CalPro, you actually start to see that the more philosophy does apply.
Right. Thank you. And then I'll get into, I hope we have a discussion about what are we doing in practice, or which dose to be, because that's a question that I get from all of our colleagues anywhere, you know, we go. You know, I have great respect for all the groups that design these studies across all three IL-23s going against ustekinumab. So again, remember when I started, I said there are two questions we have to answer. One, are they really better than the 1223s? And then two, is there a differentiation between the molecules? So here, they went directly against ustekinumab. This was the sequence study that Marla brought up earlier. And there was a very clear message here that whether you looked at endoscopic remission, mucosal healing at week 24, week 48, there was a consistent victory of risankizumab over ustekinumab, which I think, Marla, you were doing this before the study came out, but this really solidifies what you had said, right? That there's not a lot of reason to use ustekinumab anymore.
That was one of the questions I'm going to ask you both.
So. Oh, boy. Okay. We'll get ready. So that's risankizumab. Moving on to Miri. They also looked against ustekinumab and across placebo as well for moderate to severely active Crohn's disease. This is the VIVID-1 study. And this is a little bit different. What you're seeing here are, again, as expected, nice and big deltas compared to placebo. However, this is a little different story than when we looked at risankizumab, where you don't see much of a difference here between MIRI and ustekinumab. Was it a different patient population? Is the drug working differently? You know, I think it speaks for itself that it was fairly obvious in the last slide I showed you with RIZA that there was a difference over ustekinumab, which again, you know, supports your hypothesis that you beat everybody to. But we're not seeing that with mirikizumab. So what about GUS, which is, you know, our most recent addition here? When we look at GUS versus ustekinumab and Crohn's disease in the GALAXY 1 study at week 12, this is looking at CDAI score. You could see placebo has a very small drop in CDAI score, but you see across the different dose ranges of GUS that there's a much bigger drop compared to placebo and a bigger drop compared to ustekinumab. I think it's actually easier to look at week 48. So this is now looking at GUS versus USTA at week 48. This is GALAXY 2 and 3. And now you get to see the separation like we did with RIZA, where you see both endoscopic response, endoscopic remission. And I think what's the most important here, looking at clinical remission at week 48 and endoscopic response at week 48, you have a statistically significant difference across both doses of guselkumab compared to ustekinumab. So again, bringing that story that there is something different about the 23s than compared to the IL-12-23. So again, you heard the mechanistic story. Now you're seeing the data pan out both for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And before we move on to the cases, just a couple final points. And I think you brought this up earlier, David, that the studies are now including things that are really important to our patients, including fatigue and urgency. And I credit Marla with really helping bring urgency up into the forefront as something that if you ask patients what's bothering them the most, it's often urgency. So I'm so thankful that across the 23s that's been looked at. And you could see both for guselkumab, mirikizumab, and for risankizumab, that they all improve fatigue, they all improve urgency. These are helping improve the quality of lives of our patients in addition to healing their mucosa and getting rid of their typical inflammatory bowel disease symptoms. So with that, Mar, I will turn it back to you and we can get into some patient cases.
Yeah, but even before, I want to highlight some key elements because these are like incredible questions that came through.
Yeah.
And I think the dosing question is really important because for UC in particular, it seems like we struggle with both with risankizumab as well as what you see with GUS because MIRI didn't bring more than one dose into maintenance. They just brought the dose that we see. But do you, when you think about, you said more is better. We've never backed away from that. And UC in particular with our experience with TNF, do you... And actually, some of the data where it's the maintenance of remission, where you take people who were in remission and you look at were they the same people who were in remission at the end of the study, that you did see separation, for example, in GUS, and you started to see it with RIZA as well. How do you take the dosing question? Because we get asked that all the time. That was the confusion when you have two doses on the label. So, Dave, you presented and you see. How are you approaching and what dosing are you choosing?
Sure. So for risankizumab, and also want to be practical to make the office run smoothly as well, which I think is important. But for UC, so first, before I touch on UC for Crohn's, as Marla was saying, if you look at the risankizumab data, maintenance remission, but looking at steroid-free remission, some endoscopic healing, the 360 outperformed the 180. So in Crohn's, I'm 360 all the time, 180. I don't use 180, and it's just standard. Everybody in our practice does that. It's easy for everybody. For UC, if you look at those endpoints, there's not as much of a differentiation with RIZA. Right now, I'm still using the 360. Again, it's every 8 weeks for both. I think where it comes up a little bit more is what are we going to be doing for guselkumab, and we don't have that experience just yet. So nobody will probably be in maintenance, but the data, there might be some signals, but I don't think there's a huge difference if you look at the data superficially. So I think sort of diving in a little more deeper, and I think what I'm going to do practically until I see more of that data is if I have a patient that at the end of induction, at end of those first three infusions, they're great, right? Their biomarkers are normal, they're feeling great. I'm going to probably do the lower dose every 8 weeks, right? So we're talking about every 8 weeks versus every four. If I have somebody that's doing a lot better, but maybe their biomarker, their CRP is still up, or their CalPro is still up, or they still have some symptoms, I'm going to err on the side of caution, and I'm going to give them the higher dose every 4 weeks. But I think we need to get a little more data on this and see how it plays out.
Yeah, Cord, do you agree in this UC space in particular?
Yeah, I mostly agree. I mean, the only other thing I'll add is, you know, we're always playing a chess game here, right, of like what happens next if this plan doesn't make it. And I'm always thinking, I if someone's sick, I don't want to try them on a lower dose and then wait another month or so to see if the higher dose is going to work. So the patients that I'm really worried, like, I don't know where this is going, I'll put them on the high dose regardless, just thinking that if they're going to fail, I want to know right away to move on to something else as opposed to stretch it out even longer.
So just clarify one good question. We always get confused. In these re-randomized, when you show the placebo arm, these are everyone who got drug and induction.
Right, and that's sorry, I forgot. That's a great question, and I forgot to bring that up. The placebo rates are much higher in maintenance because they got drug, and most of the IL-23s, the half-lives vary a little bit, but they have a longer half-life than TNF, so that's going to last months later.
Yeah, we tend to see the carryover in these therapies that have a long half-life, and even we said if you take risankizumab because it has a really long half-life, their study duration was 64 weeks. Had they cut it earlier, it's possible you wouldn't have seen as much separation between placebo and drug because it's such a long half-life. So one of the comments was, I don't have patients talking about urgency. You just broke my heart who said that. Yeah. And you know why your patients are not talking about urgency? Because you're not asking them about urgency. Because honestly, if you look at every questionnaire, every anonymous survey, and this is what I experience as well, is my patients are embarrassed, they're ashamed, especially folks who have had an accident. We know that for a fact, that they actually don't want to bring it up because they're not sure we have a solution, or maybe it's abnormal, maybe I'm the only one, you're not asking me about it. So to be fair, my obsession with this one particular PRO is the fact that often we're just saying yes or no. We're not actually asking you the severity of your urgency. So the nuance around even what you just showed, Cora, is that everyone were asking it maybe differently. The one thing, the quantification of how severe your urgency is actually really important. And until we asked in the CONFIDE survey, the fact that many of your patients are wearing a diaper at least once a week should shake all of you to the core, and I hope that every single one of you walk out of here and on your next clinic day, you're asking a patient how severe their urgency is and whether or not they ever have to wear undergarments or diapers in order to avoid having an accident. And you're going to be shocked to your core when you ask that question. So I think it's important, and thank you for telling me that and you're disclosing that to me, that I think it's important.
Yeah, and just how you ask it, too. So they might not say urgency, right? So I have patients that say they have constipation, and that's urgency, right? They have to run to the bathroom immediately. They can't go. They sit on there. So it's how you ask it, asking it in different ways is extremely important.
Because you're right. I mean, people will say, you know, can you hold it? You know, no one's going to understand what's your deferral time, or, you know, like how long can you confer a poop, you know, and that doesn't actually resonate. So I think asking is like the one thing to share, have patients share their urgency stories. I think that's really impactful. You already highlighted actually the safety story, and you meant Akinditib vedotin. So I think that was important that you highlighted that, and that was picked up upon. And the question was, do you think it's because it's more targeted? Like, what do you think drives the safety of IL-23? Hypothesis, of course.
I think with, at least when ustekinumab first came out, I think there was a concern over it until we realized how really targeted it is. And I think it's when there's inflammation, that's when it's active and targeting the intestine. It's not just suppressing, you know, at all points in time. And again, we have such a long history with this class. So ustekinumab, I always thought was extremely safe. So now we're going even more targeted. You know, it's expected, and we're seeing the same thing.
Some of the other really great questions around, you know, why the different designs and also the different dosing and how to interpret it all. I mean, it's just the nature of the study designs, which you nicely show that, and we're moving towards more treat straight through, because that's what we do in clinic. When do we ever go, oh, you're feeling so good, I'm not going to give you nothing. You know, like, that doesn't happen, but that sort of a design that we were used to, but more and more folks are moving. You need less people to do actually a street straight through design, so you can get your study done probably quicker because you don't need as many people to win.
Right. I mean, and that's what I look at. Forget about all these numbers, right? We just showed you, right? Is it treat straight through, is randomized withdrawal? How many patients were bioexposed before going into the trial? What were the differences, right? These are three or four points you could look at and get a good general sense on what's going on with the therapy.
So as a lot of the other questions are positioning, so we're going to go into the cases because I'm going to highlight some of the questions that have been asked on how you position and when do you use these therapies. So let's meet Gavin, and this is where we're going to get audience participation as well because we're going to ask you a few questions, more to just see where people's thoughts are on the application of these this class. So 28-year-old, diagnosed 8 months ago, left-sided UC, pretty classic patient. Of course, like my friend in the audience who said, my patients aren't worrying about urgency, he's not talking about his urgency and sort of embarrassed.
Marla's not upset about this.
No, I'm hardly going to try and hunt you down. No, I'm kidding. It's such an important thing because that actually...
It's the same person who said I was wrong.
Present yourself after. No. So 28-year-old, left-sided UC, you know, average weight, 6 months of cramping, multiple loose stools, moderately active, Mayo 2, confirmed on endoscopy, as you see every day in practice. And guess what, Core? Per your graph, the patient with moderate severely active disease was put on a drug that is approved for mild to moderate. How do you like that? With prednisone. And no history of treatment with the biologic. So pretty standard, bio-naive, left-sided colitis, typical approach, mesalamine, prednisone, we're going to see how you do. So let's ask the team here on stage and in the audience and those of you virtually, what would you do next? So would you increase the dose of pred and reevaluate, meaning give him a chance to give him a higher dose? You're saying no, Core, already.
Sorry.
Answers. Would you start Vito? Would you start an S1P, naive population? 70% of folks in the S1P trials were bio-naive, left-sided, et cetera. Start an anti-TNF, or would you start an IL-23, or you're not sure? So let's vote.
You with a sad face, come up to my place and live it up. You beside the dance floor, what do you cry for? Let's live it up. You with a sad face, come up to my place and live it up. You beside the dance floor, what do you
cry for? Well, good, we can go home. We've done our job now. So really spread across, as it should be, I think, that... can you go back so we can still talk about the answers, guys? Thanks. So I just want your interpretation, both of you.
Yeah.
So, Core, tell me how you'd approach a naive and where do you position your therapies here?
So, first of all, I don't think, other than the top one, I don't think any of these are wrong answers. I think, you know, the world is our oyster here. This is a patient where I honestly think all of these choices are very reasonable to consider. I think I'm not sure is actually a fair answer, too, because I don't know that we have the right answer of what the next step is here. This patient is a great candidate for IL-23s. I think, to me, in my practice, I probably wouldn't have started anti-TNF here, but it's not an unreasonable thing to do. This is a patient population where S1Ps, you know, can be effective, so I think that's reasonable. And again, depending on kind of how much time you have and if they're hanging in there, you know, veto's not crazy either. So, I mean, I'm not going to come down and say this is one right answer. The wrong answer is to perseverate on this and let your patient go home without a plan, or to the person who said they don't have trouble with that prior auth is still a big problem. If you commit to one drug and you've promised your patient that you're going to get this drug, and you're going to be fighting 6 weeks, you know, to get a drug, that's the wrong decision. Give your patient the drug that you think that together you came up with is your first choice, and I come up with the second choice, and I even often come up with a third choice so that we can quickly move through them. It is going to be important in our patient's care at many points to be precise about an exact drug that we need, but I think in this bio-naive group, we do have some flexibility, and we just need to get them treated, like on something.
Yeah, Dave, what do you think? Like, how do you today, tomorrow you're going to go to clinic, let's say you're on Thursday, what drug are you choosing? Like, tell the audience, like, how do you approach a left-sided bio-naive patient? What's your drug of choice?
Yeah, so I agree completely with Corey. It starts with efficacy, and in this patient, probably all these therapies are going to work well, right? So then you start thinking about other things, safety, do they have EIMs and so forth. So if I take somebody that's moderate, bio-naive, has been on multiple courses of steroids, this is where in my practice I'm using Veto or an IL-23 and the S1P's play, right? That's where I'm starting with one of those. What I'm doing, probably a little bit less S1Ps, Veto and 23s are probably similar, and then it comes to an infusion every 8 weeks versus an injection every 8 weeks. Start talking about that. When you're more severe, that's when, not in this case, that's when I think you start talking about infliximab, upadacitinib, and so forth. But in that, that's what we're discussing.
Yes, this is just a moderate severe Mayo 2. I will say that in the clinical trials for both GUS and risankizumab, 7 out of 10 patients had a Mayo score of 3 at the start of the trial. That's even in the naives. And the fact that we have never seen 70% plus endo improvement, when's the last time we saw that kind of data? I mean, all of us have been looking at this data for a very long time. Never was I able to show in a bio-naive that like 7 out of 10 of our patients are going to have a 0 or a 1. It just was the numbers we were seeing, particularly with 23s, and not just because we're here because it's a Janssen-sponsored, you know, event. It would be the same. We would have this conversation, and even the HEMI part, you mentioned it. So let's go after HEMI for a minute. Explain what HEMI is and whether we're at a point where we need to treat to histo-remission.
Okay. So we have our colonoscopy, and HEMI, I'm sure you guys have seen it in different ways. It's just, is histologically normal, right? A lot of times you might visibly see something that looks great, you take a biopsy and it comes back mildly active chronic colitis, and they're just measuring how many neutrophils are there, and there's some other fancier things you can measure. So I think it speaks to, when you look at it in the trial, it speaks to the efficacy of the therapy. And if you start seeing deltas there, big differences, in my mind it says this therapy really works well. Am I treating to that? Am I adjusting therapy because of that? No, because if you still look at the rates, these are pretty low, right? So this, you're talking 20, 30%, you know, at most you're seeing these numbers. So I think it speaks to the therapy. I also think we need to learn how to do it a little bit better, how it's measured. I think there are some issues there. Sometimes we'll see a completely normal or higher histology, right, and lower endoscopy, and it doesn't make as much sense, but I think it's something that's important. And I also think, maybe not histology, but when we're talking about endoscopy Mayo 01, and I know it's not your exact question, where are they in their journey, right? So if somebody is like this, right, and they're feeling a lot better, but they're not, right, that colon's not normal, I'm going to be more likely to make some type of an adjustment in this patient population than if somebody that's maybe failed 2 or 3 therapies, right? So I think we should be working to get our patients into as deep of a remission as possible. And this is the type of patient we should work on it, since they're naive and early on.
I mean, my comment on endo improvement being 70s, have we ever, the endo remission, Mayo 0 in the 50s?
Yeah.
I mean, these are, like, did we ever say to our patient of where you're going to get you to a Mayo 0? It just wasn't right. in our narrative,
it's
and now
reach.
We can. So within reach, right. Yes. So I think just understanding and studying the therapies and saying that we are moving towards, and finally, you know, stride 3, to be fair, I said was histologic remission. Mm-hmm. We're not there yet. So we've got stride 1, we have stride 2, but there hasn't been enough data yet for stride 3 because we don't know for sure that histo is more important and or equally or better than endo alone. And that's why no stride 3 has come out and say histo. However, there's a verdict trial which is looking at whether or not achieving histo is more important for outcomes than just endo alone. So I think we're exploring that, and I think we'll get more data. But I think the naive space is important for us to get it right. And I really believe that where we fall short, to be fair, is that we are using a drug that is approved for mild to moderate and expecting patients with a Mayo score, of endoscopic score of 3, to be maintained with a drug that is not approved for moderate to severe disease. And I think that's like a really, hopefully everyone takes that comment in and understands what I'm trying to get at, is that if this patient is a moderate to severe patient and needs to be on a drug that's approved. So let's talk about Sheila as the second case, just to hone in on another big struggle that we have. By the way, this patient is a female patient. I asked you, you were talking about S1P's verses.
Yes.
Would a female of childbearing potential impact which treatment you would have chosen if Gavin was Gail?
Yeah, no, it's a
what
great...
What happened here?
It's,
I haven't asked the question. Yeah, I'm just giving Gavin another name in terms of would that mend a difference?
No, it's a great point, right? So I think we're very comfortable across the board with our biologics for pregnancy, for breastfeeding, and so forth. But our small molecules, there's theoretical concern, some animal data that's there. So we have other therapies that are very effective that have great endoscopic remission, as Marla was saying. I'm not going to start somebody on an S1P who's a young female that's then going to potentially have to switch in a year when we have great other options. So I don't start it in that patient.
Yeah, I think I just want to make that point because I forgot that patient, you know, the patient in front of you is also going to make a difference. So, Cor, this is Sheila. She's on adalimumab every 2 weeks. And she's, after 9 months, she's sort of having a recurrence of symptoms. Her scope, you can see here, pretty significant, Mayo 3 up to 60, so all the way up, let's say, to the splenic flexure. You see her CalPro, CRP with a normal being 0.5, so I'm going to give her a CRP elevation because that does, and you see that's important as well, and obviously C. diff and infectious workup negative. So we're going to ask again the audience, we're going to put up that question, and then, Cor, I'm going to have you interpret. So what would you do next? Would you escalate her to weekly adalimumab? Would you switch her to infliximab? I think that's like a really cool question to ask, and I want you guys' opinion. Have you really failed TNF if you've only failed adalimumab in UC? I think Crohn's, we would have a different answer than in UC. Switch to vedolizumab. This is a TNF or adalimumab failure. Switch to ustekinumab. Switch to IL-23, S1P, or switch to a JAKER, I'm not sure, and God, this laundry list is so long now. We're trying to understand how to position and what's the next best therapy. So let's vote.
Interesting.
Cor, interpret what the data tells us here. Now, in this particular scenario, we showed for Riza, for example, that really the power was in the naives, less so in the refractory. But then you showed Gus, where it actually, the delta between placebo and drug were very similar. And I would even venture to tell you that if you went to Hemi, even with Gus, you're seeing like triple the delta. I mean, there's a depth difference. So, and then you have JAKs, which are designed, and we can't, and labeled, to use after a TNF failure. So, I don't know if it's because we're all at an IL-23 night tonight, I'm not sure, but I really want to know, first I'm going to ask Corey, and then you're going to interpret your data, but what would you do in a patient who's on every other week? Let's assume her drug level is whatever we think it to be therapeutic. It's not zero. There's no anti-drug antibodies. Pretty significant Mayo 3 female patient. Maybe that did impact because I sort of set up on the S1Ps. Maybe that made a difference. What would you have treated this patient with in your practice tomorrow?
I'll start with what I wouldn't do is number one. I think dose escalation of ADA in a patient with moderate to severe, in this case more severe UC, isn't going to get us there, and it's not a drug that, I'll be honest, I can't remember the last time I prescribed adalimumab for a patient with ulcerative colitis. So I'm looking for an excuse to get them off of that, so that wouldn't be something I would go. Although, you know, we teach about therapeutic drug monitoring. It's not an unreasonable thing to consider, but I will tell you, you're not going to get there. You're just going to kick the can down the road until you get to a better drug. I actually would go with an IL-23 here for a couple reasons. One, it's a safe drug. We have data, as you said now with Gus, that the difference between bio-naive and bio-experience isn't significant enough to make me concerned about it. It's a young woman, as you talked about, who may be interested in having children and or more if she has some already. So that thinking about a JAK inhibitor right here does have that... It doesn't take it off the table, but it's just a conversation to be thoughtful about.
So let's say that it was Gavin
Yeah.
So take the pregnancy off the table because I want you to say Converse.
Mm-hmm.
Does speed matter? And actually, already by 1 week with Gus, there's actually already symptom improvement. We didn't talk as much about speed here, actually, which we should. But does speed matter? And does that ever make you use one therapy or another for Jack versus non-Jack?
Yeah, so speed matters particularly because now we're on the second drug. Like now they've been sick for a while and we need to do something. So I do not take Jack off the table at all here. And I think Jack does have great efficacy very, very quickly. And we've all had that experience. But again, we're seeing the same with Gus too. So it makes it a very good first choice here. I want to comment on infliximab because you brought this up. And we had a low audience response of that, although I think that's a very reasonable way to go here with ulcerative colitis. And it drives me crazy when we look at data and say anti-TNF failure and don't differentiate
for UC,
and we don't differentiate infliximab versus the other anti-TNF. So pre having all of these choices, I would definitely have gone to infliximab here. Now that we have new mechanisms, including 23s and JAKs, in this patient, I would probably go to a 23. I have JAK sort of in waiting right there as well. And I would have a conversation about infliximab. We start talking about extraintestinal manifestations and think through the different options. But to me, I would either do IL-23 or have a conversation about JAK or infliximab.
Guys, can you scroll up? We don't see the JAK scoring here. We just, it's scroll down, I'm sorry. There you go.
Oh, look at that.
So here's the JAK. Dave, how do you approach this patient?
Yeah, so similar to Corey, so I think first what I wouldn't do, so I think this is where, so Vito, there's good data to show works great bio-naive, not as much bio-exposed. So Vito, definitely not. Even if it was a male patient, S1P, as Marla said, 70% of these patients in the trials were bio-naive, similar data. So definitely no Vito, definitely no S1P. When you're talking about, let's say, ustekinumab versus a selective IL-23 inhibitor, we don't have that head-to-head in ulcerative colitis, but I think the common theme you've been hearing is with selective IL-23 inhibitors, uzelkumab, we see great endoscopic remission rates and better than what we've seen at a different time with ustekinumab, so I wouldn't use ustekinumab, right? So now we're talking about an IL-23 inhibitor, upadacitinib, which is reasonable, and I agree with Corey completely. If we didn't have these options, going to infliximab would be sort of towards the top. Since we have other options, why not change the mechanism? And I think between IL-23 inhibitors, look, we need more real-world data, right? As Corey said, is a bio-exposed patient from one trial to the other? Are these the same patients, the same exposures? But if you look at what we have now, right, uzelcumab does well, bio-naive, bio-exposed, Riza doesn't. Miri does well, bio-naive, bio-exposed, but their endpoints weren't as hard, right? So I'll go with the data until we have more of that, and that's what I would lean towards. And this is where, which I agree with Corey, and I know I'm jumping around a little bit, but when you talk to your patients, that first patient, I do the same thing. You don't want to say, go on this therapy, it doesn't get approved. This one, I'll pick one, and I'll fight with the insurance, and I'll explain to the patient, look, we have a couple of options here. We don't have as many. We're going to keep fighting for this. It might take some time. But this one, I'll be a little more, stern on therapy.
I totally agree. And that comment was specifically about a patient who's not that sick, and you got to get them on drug. Right. Here, you do want to be more precise.
So is there, based on the answers that we just got, is there a patient you wouldn't use a 23? Because based on both of these patients, 23 was the first choice. Tell the audience and those listening virtually, who's a patient that you need to think differently about? What is the phenotype?
So I think just this is the issue when we say moderate to severe. What does that mean, right? We're talking about activity, not the complexity. So we could go into that, but whoever's on the severe end, right, however you define that, that doesn't necessarily need to be in the hospital. But anybody I'm concerned about, they're getting upadacitinib or infliximab. That's where I'm not sort of using that IL-23, right? But along that spectrum, moderate to severe, moderate all the way to the end, I think it works great. That top end, those sick patients, I'm using UPA or infliximab. And it's what is a little difficult is how do you define that patient and how do we sort of, talk about it since the moderate to severe category sort of encompasses everybody.
So Corey and Crohn's, answer that question. Who wouldn't use a 23 in Crohn's disease?
I think someone who failed well-dosed infliximab with good drug levels that is sick and you're thinking the next time you hear from them it's going to be in the emergency department, I'm going to upadacitinib. And I'm not sure how they would do with an IL-23 in that scenario. We don't exactly know that patient population, but to me, if I'm really concerned about them and they have truly failed infliximab, like a primary failure to infliximab, the JAK inhibitors, specifically upadacitinib, is the drug I trust.
Perianal Crohn's disease. Is that a phenotype that you would choose one therapy over another?
Yeah. I bet you the IL-23s work in perianal Crohn's disease, and we have preliminary data to tell us that. But, you know, we don't have the well-designed ACCENT-2 trial that we have with infliximab. When perianal disease is a prominent part of their disease, I'm often going to infliximab, and I know that I can increase the dose and really push trough levels that I think we need to get close to levels of around 20 from trough levels to really get under their perianal disease under control, and that's a choice that I would make if it was, you know, again, there's perianal disease and there's perianal disease. But I bet you that IL-23s, we will continue to get more data and feel more comfortable using it.
Yeah. Dave, is there a particular patient population? You talked about EIMs a little bit. Does that steer you? Because not all arthritis are the same.
Yes.
Psoriatic arthritis behaves differently than synovial true RA. So does that matter as to which one you would choose?
Yeah, I think this is going to be an interesting story, and I think there's an opportunity here. We're not quite there yet. So just how you talked about urgency, how you ask about joint pain, we do a pretty bad job about it. Most of us, including myself, do have joint pains. They say no. 5 minutes later, they're telling they can't walk because their back's hurting, right? They didn't realize that was a joint. So you have to ask about it. Generally, central spondyloarthropathy, so back pain, back inflammation, I'm doing a TNF or a JAK or upadacitinib. Peripheral, I think the 23s work well, but I do think there are going to be some more nuanced where I think there's an opportunity here maybe for all or maybe just for some of the selective IL-23 inhibitors to work well in certain types of spondyloarthropathy. So what you showed earlier in that New England Journal article is I don't think all spondyloarthropathy is the same. But for right now, if it's central, they're getting a JAK or TNF. Peripheral, I think the 23s are great.
Yeah, I mean, we could literally, like, nuance the crap out of everybody, you know, in terms of the that's why that questionnaire at the beginning, it's these nuances, right, and the fact that there's so many nuances around managing an IBD patient that I think if we stick to the fact, any therapy at diagnosis that you feel good about, that you can get in your patient's belly, leg, or arm, or through their, you know, in their mouth, I don't actually care, because I think we're just wasting time, and this progression of irreversible bowel wall damage is why we're still going to the operating room 50% of the time. Something has to give. So for me, if everyone feels more comfortable because we've got a safer alternative, use it, right? I think those are really the messaging for me, and that we have a lot. And the other point would be is that if adalimumab is the least effective UC drug, we need to stop using it. And I really believe these are, like, important sort of concepts now that we have all of these therapies. So we need to move, right? We need to look at what the network metas look like. We need to look what the guidance, you know, guidelines look like and move forward. So I think at the end of the day, you know, I think we sort of understand clearly where the field is going. This is the IL-23 revolution, no matter how you look at it. There are nuances. Corey sort of talked a little bit about maybe how the MOAs may be differentiating. And as you said, we'll look at the data and we'll interpret it as we move forward. So again, to learn more, you can click on the Materials and Resources tab to access the additional resources. And really, I want to thank all of you for, like, incredible questions. If you have more that you want to ask, because there's like 20 others here that we weren't able to even get to, please come on, you know, up and we can talk. If there are specific questions, we'd love to be able to help. And thank you for spending your time with us, and we hope you have a great rest of the meeting. You're going to see the IL-23, Galaxy, and Gravity on Wednesday, so go to the session. You're going to see the sub-Q induction data with Gus. Okay? really cool data. So hopefully we'll see you at the rest of the meeting, and thank you again for spending your evening with us. So.